from the inner city helping homeless. He's their head of communications, Brian McLaughlin. Brian, good afternoon and welcome to the programme, firstly.
Afternoon, Donny. How are you?
I am well. Brian, I am looking at something here which distresses me greatly, and as you and I know, we've been friends for a long time. The whole homelessness issue and the events, I suppose, and circumstances surrounding homelessness is very distressing to, well, to me, but to personally to, I would imagine, to everybody who's familiar with it. But according to what you and Anthony have stated recently, that being Anthony Flynn, the CEO of the Inner City Helping Homeless, it's about to get a hell of a lot worse.
Yeah, Donny, I mean, that's certainly the feeling. I mean, for the last number of years, as you know, we've been calling for rent freezes and bans on evictions to try and tackle the homeless crisis and the housing crisis. Now, we were told previously, of course, that that wasn't constitutional and that couldn't be done. But obviously, the COVID-19 pandemic changed everything in that the things that previously we were told couldn't be done were suddenly done very quickly. And we've seen a massive decrease in the number of people that are homeless over the last 3 months as a result of that, because so many people become homeless from the private rental market with it being so unstable. So I suppose our biggest fear is that there's a backlog of evictions waiting, that when the ban on evictions does drop and gets lifted, we're going to see a huge avalanche of people becoming homeless all at once. And I suppose that's a huge, huge concern for ourselves.
Now, just before we move on, Brian, there's something I want you to clarify for me, if you're in a position to do it, and it's something you alluded to there. That when you were calling for a freeze or a ban on evictions and rent freezes and all these other things, I mean, the mantra was, this is unconstitutional, we can't do it. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but to amend the Constitution, the only way you can amend the Constitution, I was given to understand, was by a vote of the people. So we didn't have one of those. That being a referendum, I think that's the only way you can actually amend the Constitution.
Well, it'd be an emergency legislation that would have been put in place as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. But I suppose our biggest concern, or the thing that we've been shouting from the rooftops, as you well know, is we were in a state of emergency with the housing crisis. It was a national emergency. At one stage, as we know, Leo actually made the mistake of using that language. But of course, when he was called out on it, well, if it's a national emergency, where's the emergency sitting up the door? Where's the legislation changes that can be done literally overnight, like was done in 2008 when the banks collapsed and AMMO was formed? Of course, then suddenly the wording changed, and well, no, it's not a national emergency to the level of that. But we've just shown this year, like we consistently said, it can be done. The will has to be there to do it. What's happened this year is that COVID-19 forced our hand. And it's just shown and highlighted to everybody, I hope, that for all the years of them saying this wasn't possible to do, it can be done. And it's had a direct impact immediately on the homeless figures. So that shows you that the will has to be there to do it, but it can be done.
Brian, we are hearing anecdotally, and I'm sure you are watching this like a hawk, that a lot of corporate entities are looking at the situation which currently pertains, where they have a lot of their staff who are now working from home quite efficiently and quite successfully. The logical follow-on from this is that there may be quite a number of commercial premises, let us put it that way, which will no longer be needed, or certainly the volume of them that are currently in use will no longer be needed. What do you think is the possibility that some of these may be taken and revamped and turned into accommodation units for homeless people?
Oh, it could absolutely be done, Donny, and I think you're absolutely right there. Like, I'll give you an example. A friend of mine works for an insurance company that has a couple of buildings around the city centre, and you know, he has said to me that because they were able to transition so many people to working from home very quickly, that he would be surprised if they kept all of the buildings come next year, because it's huge rent, it's huge running costs, and they realise now that they don't actually need to do that. So the working from home side of things could have two benefits. Number one, like you say, it might free up buildings within the city centre that could be converted into one bedroom units or supported accommodation for people that maybe have mental health issue or an addiction issue. the other side of it is something that, again, we've sat down with some of the biggest tech companies in the city. We sat in meeting rooms with them up, you know, as of 2 years ago. And one thing that we raised with them actually 2 years ago to one of the biggest ones was that the tech companies had a huge opportunity to alleviate the pressure on the housing market in Dublin by allowing their staff to work from home, because that would mean that, say, for example, you work from home 4 days a week, you were on site one day for any on-site meetings. That would mean that instead of everyone trying to rent in Dublin city centre to be near their job, they could purchase homes outside the city centre in the likes of Mullingar, Longford, Mayo, as far away as they want, where they can get much better value on the home they're looking to buy, that they can actually get on the property ladder. But it also means that they can work from home. So that takes a huge amount of pressure off the rental space around the city centre where these offices are based. So the tech companies had this power 2 years ago to make a difference. Now that they've had to do it, just like the government, because of COVID-19, I think you are going to see a big case where working from home becomes the norm for a lot of people. And I think that in itself could have a huge beneficial impact on the housing crisis and on homelessness.
And of course, the other side of it, which this might be the time to beat this particular drum, is that it would also be of a huge benefit to the environment, because obviously if you have less people having to travel to work in the metropolises, then you have less cars on the road, vis-a-vis you have less pollution, and it's a win-win all the way around.
Correction, Elena, that's absolutely spot on there. And I mean, the other thing I would say on that is, and it's something that I've noticed even myself coming back into work for a few hours a day, the amount of time people lose commuting to work. And you know yourself, if you get stuck in a bad traffic jam and it takes you an hour and 20 minutes just to get to your job, you don't start your day off in good mental health position, because you're frustrated at the length of time it took your journey to get in. Like, people could be losing 2 to 2.5 hours of their day. By working from home, that's completely removed. They're way more efficient in their timekeeping because they're on site, they're at home for the whole day. And from feedback I've been getting from, I used to work at eBay, for example, and a lot of my friends I talked to there have been saying that the working from home is really working and the targets are being hit and people are less stressed because they're not getting into a situation where they're leaving the house 2 hours before their shift starts to get to travel and get in, make sure they get in on time. All of that is completely removed as well. So yes, it has the environmental side of things, definitely a big benefit there. But it also has a huge impact on housing and homelessness, and also on the mental health of the workers themselves. And I think we've kind of fallen upon something that we knew could make a difference, but because of COVID-19, we're now seeing exactly how much of a difference it can make. So we need to sustain that going on long term, beyond COVID-19 and into 2021 and beyond.
Brian, talk to me about the effect of the coronavirus on I'll actually break it into two segments for you, and to give you a good run at the answer. The effect of the coronavirus on homeless people and the effect of coronavirus on people who are sleeping rough sleepers. Those two brackets, and I'll push it out another little bit, Brian, while I'm at it. The way that the inner city helping homeless organisation have had to adapt and change in order to provide the service, which you have maintained throughout this pandemic.
So I suppose the first point would be, we're very thankful that from what we understand and from the reports we hear from Dr. Oslo Carroll in Safety Net, and from the feedback we received, that the number of cases and deaths within the homeless services was quite low. So that's absolutely a positive. You know, we would definitely say that that's a good thing. Now, we do have a lot of unanswered questions still regarding, you know, we heard that there was 1,000 extra spaces, including hotel rooms, available for people that were homeless if they had any symptoms, for example. Where we were frustrated was they were still piling people into a hostel. If, for example, the room had maybe 12 people in it at one point, it still had 6 people in it. So the risk element was still there. People were still sharing a room and an accommodation with someone that wasn't in their family unit. So the risk element was huge. And I suppose part of our frustration was we knew that all these hotel rooms were being boxed off by home services and by the department. But were they being paid for while they were sitting empty? And if they were being paid for while they were sitting empty, what's the point in having six people in one room in a hostel when you could have two people in one room in a hostel and four other people use these hotel rooms that were being paid for and sitting empty anyway? So we still have a lot of unanswered questions, but thank God we're in a position where, from what we understand, there wasn't a huge amount of deaths within homelessness, and that's obviously to be commended. Now, to kind of flip it on to the rough sleeper people and, you know, the people that our teams would be dealing with, there was a lot of uncertainty out in the streets. There was a lot of fear. A lot of people didn't want to go into any accommodation because of the fears of social distancing and the fact that, you know, COVID-19 was so transferable, and a lot of people on the streets might have underlying health issues like respiratory issues or whatever the case may be. What our teams reported back to us was one of the things that really emphasised to them just how much the homeless community can be forgotten about was we were hearing about washing your hands up to 20 times a day. But when everything went into lockdown, any of the cafes, the fast food restaurants, the libraries, the places that the homeless people would go to wash their hands were suddenly all closed. So there was nowhere for them to go to actually maintain the hygiene levels that they want and that we were advised to do. So we actually had a situation where some of our teams actually went out separate of outreach, not bringing any supplies with them, but specifically going out to wash people's hands, to sanitise their tents for them. So our teams adapted the service to do that as well, to try and keep people as safe as possible. And then obviously seeing them every single day and keeping regular touch with them to make sure that they were okay. We were fortunate in that we have a connection with Safety Nest, who do fantastic work on the front line. So if our teams came across anybody that they felt in any way was symptomatic, they could get onto Safety Net. Safety Net will come out and do a COVID test on them. So in that sense, it worked very well, but there was definitely still an element that the homeless people were forgotten about. We're just very, very lucky that the number of cases and deaths within homelessness wasn't as high as we would have maybe feared.
Brian, you mentioned hotels and hotel rooms there. Now, as we know, moves are afoot to reopen our economy, and I think the plan is that come the 20th of July and certainly the first or second week in August, that if everything stays as it is numbers wise, our economy will be fully reopened again. That begs the question, Brian, if that is going to be the situation, that means all hotels will be back functioning as hotels. Now, my understanding is that some of these hotels at the moment are accommodating people who are in the homeless category. So that means they're going to get turfed out the front door of these hotels again. Am I wrong?
I'd say you're wrong to a degree, Donny, in that there's a lot of hotels that are housing and accommodating homeless families going back years. So the families that are in those places that were in there long before COVID-19 was ever even talked about, they would be secure because they would have contracts. But what we would fear is anyone that was put into a hotel or an Airbnb or a short-term holiday let through COVID-19 absolutely will be at risk of being put back into a hostel or into an emergency accommodation or back onto the streets, depending on the situation. So again, that is a big concern of ours. But I think as probably yourself and your listeners are well aware of, we don't know what's ahead of us over the next coming weeks. When you see videos like Temple Bar and so forth, you do ask yourself, are we going to get a second wave? Will everything be able to open again come the end of July? So there's a lot of up-in-the-air hypothetical questions that still have to be answered. So I suppose we don't know what's going to happen, but we do know that absolutely there are people in hotels or in the accommodation industry or the tourist accommodation industry that took money throughout COVID-19 to accommodate homeless people because of the lack of tourists in the country. That is going to change. So we would expect to see that happening, absolutely. And I suppose another caveat for people to think about is we've also had an issue over the last 3 months where people are finding it very hard to register as homeless because the likes of Parkgate Hall, where people would go and register as homeless to avail of accommodation, are closed. We were in a position where people were ringing Parkgate Hall to say they were homeless and that they were registering and that they were rough sleeping. And the process was that they had to sleep on the streets for a couple of nights. The assertive outreach team from the DRHE had to actually engage with them on the street before they would register them as homeless and allow them to access accommodation. So that was a huge, huge issue for us and something we felt was very, very wrong, because if someone needs accommodation tonight, they shouldn't have to sleep out, be seen to be sleeping out by the assertive outreach team before they can register as homeless. And we had a huge issue with that.
That is an absolute scandal. and I don't care what pandemic or what situation is, but that, it's the first I've heard of it, Brian, and I have to be honest with you, that is, that's deplorable. That just should not be happening in the island of 2020, and I don't care what pandemics or what situations pertain, that's totally unacceptable.
Yeah, it's completely wrong. I mean, for an individual person that's become homeless for whatever the reason may be, wanting to avail of accommodation, even though they might not want to go into emergency accommodation, but knowing that that's really the only option available to them. But to be told, okay, well, if you're out in the street, our teams need to engage with you a couple of times before we can actually support you in getting that accommodation. That's an absolute, as you say, it's an absolute scandal. I mean, people should not be treated in that way. And we've had numerous reports of that from different people coming back to us over the last 3 months. So, in our case, we would always try and advocate on behalf of these people and say, well, look, we've been dealing with them. They've come to us for stuff. So here's a letter from ICHH. Why can't that be sufficient? Because we are dealing with these people. So we know for a fact that they're out there. But that's, again, something that it takes away the human contact. It takes away the humanity. As I say, if COVID-19 wasn't happening, they could walk into Parkgate Hall with their ID and register as homeless. So they should be allowed to do that if they're out on the streets and Parkgate Hall is closed. That should still be an option for them. But we were hearing over and over again that our teams need to deal, our assertive outreach team need to see on the street before they'll actually register you as homeless, and that's very, very wrong.
That's unbelievable. It's just deplorable. Brian, we have a new government. They're a week and, 2 days in situ now. Have you had a meeting or have you a meeting scheduled with the new Minister for Housing?
We've reached out by letter to the minister asking for a meeting. We did meet him about 2 years ago in the Dáil. We gave a lot of feedback regarding what we felt wasn't being done correctly in homeless services and what could be done to actually change things. The follow-up meeting that was promised never materialised, but I suppose now we're in the position that he is the housing minister, so we would like to sit down with Darragh O'Brien and say, look, let's go over what we did with you 2 years ago, but also let's update you on what's going on out there now. I suppose we're all sitting on the fence to a certain degree because we don't know what he is going to implement. You hear that the sound bites of affordable housing from anywhere from €160,000 up to €250,000. But obviously we don't know. The devil is in the detail. We're hearing about the state having a certain equity stake in these properties if people are buying them, first-time buyers are buying them. We don't know how much that equity stake is going to be. We don't know what way it's going to look. But fundamentally, it sounds to us like they're going to be paying huge numbers for each unit as well, taking it from private developers at 350,000-400,000. Yes, it's more affordable for the buyer, but they still have to pay that equity stake back to actually own the property outright themselves. When we know, as we've spoken about many times, O'Coolan Housing can build public housing on public lands for legitimately between €160,000 and €230,000 without any state subsidies, without any equity stake being owed by the government. So there's a lot of unanswered questions. We're hearing the sound bites, but we need to see the actual full policy before we'll commit to whether it's a good thing or a bad thing.
Yeah, and not only can O'Coolan build them for those prices, they are building them for those prices and have built them. I think the cheapest I heard, and I'm open to correction on this, but I think it was somewhere around 130,000-140,000 they managed to build houses. And when we talk, ladies and gentlemen, about building houses, we're not talking about the four walls and the roof. These are fully kitted out, walk-in, everything is there for that kind of money. So it beggars belief that if one organisation can do it, that a government can't do it. This is the bit that nobody has been able to explain to my satisfaction, Brian.
I would agree with you, Donny. And I mean, again, it's something that everyone in homelessness has been beating the drum of for the last 4 or 5 years, is we can't keep relying on private landlords and private developers to sort a social problem. And it seems to me it's dressed up a bit differently, but it looks like we're still going to be relying on those private landlords and those private developers. And that's not the solution to the problem. It's not the long-term solution. And, I suppose we hear about these enhanced leasings that the government, I'll give you an example. There's these enhanced leasings that the government will be taking out from your build-to-let companies like the Irish REITs and these companies. A 25-year enhanced lease where they will lease the property from the private landlord to use for social homes for 25 years. It goes down on official government figures as a new build. So it'll be classed in the figure. If you look at a figure that they put out, you'll see the number of new bills. That will be included in it. But again, after 25 years, they've paid all this money to a private landlord, but they won't own one brick of the property after 25 years. So where does that make sense rather than building the social and affordable housing themselves and owning that property and having it in the stake stock for the next 100 plus years? So again, you have to look at the detail behind what's being put out there. A new build that's classified as a new build in a government report, in theory, should mean that the government have built it and the government own it. It's going to go into that report as that, but in reality, it's a 25-year enhanced lease from a private company that still owned the property at the end of the 25 years.
Yeah, and that makes so much sense because, yeah, you'd get dead air if you were waiting for an answer to that, you'd get a lot of dead air.
Two words, balance books.
Now, just in relation to something that Brian mentioned there and that we spoke about was the full reopening of the country, and Brian did allude to what we saw in some of the streets, particularly, I think, Dame Lane over the weekend in Dublin. And just to bring you an update on that, my friends, the Taoiseach Micheál Martin, I think that's about the second or third time I've had to say that, has issued a statement to say that the full reopening of pubs on the 20th of July could be delayed if the rules are flouted. So that is hot off the presses for you from the Taoiseach himself. Tell me this, mentioning the Taoiseach himself, Dara O'Brien and various other things, or Dara O'Brien, how much confidence have you that things will improve, Brian?
I would absolutely say at this moment in time, I have none. I haven't sat down with Dara O'Brien and gone through things in more detail with him. As I say, we're seeing a lot of sound bites and what potentially could be done. But for me, it's all about the detail behind it. I mean, one of the biggest frustrations that we had in previous engagements with Dara was he had been very quick to go out and be outspoken about Owen Murphy and wanting Owen Murphy out of the job. But when it came to any of the votes of confidence in Owen Murphy, he chose to abstain. Now, as far as I'm concerned and we're concerned, abstaining from a vote like that, you might as well be voting to keep him in the job, because by abstaining and your party abstaining, it's going to go through that he keeps his job. So coming out the other side then saying how bad of a job he's done is a complete contradiction to the way you voted in the no confidence votes. So as we know, there's a political quagmire in there in the Dáil, and I suppose we don't know what's going to happen. I suppose the one thing that I would hope I have a bit more faith in compared to maybe to Owen Murphy is there's a lot of quote-unquote shadowy figures within the Dáil, civil servants that are brought in as advisors and that tell the ministers what they can and can't do. And I think maybe Owen Murphy hadn't got the strength of character being so young in politics to stand up to these people and say, no, sorry, I don't agree with you. This has to happen and it should happen. I would hope with Dara's experience and the length of time he's a politician that he will have more courage to step up to these people and say, look, saying it can't be done is not good enough. We're going to get it done. Find a way to get it done for me. And I think he needs to be stronger than Owen Murphy was with these people we don't see that have a huge impact, that pull the strings in the background as to what goes on within housing and homelessness. So I would hope that him being a stronger and a more experienced character in politics, that he will stand up to these people and say, I'm not accepting that. This is a problem that needs to be addressed now. Here's my solutions and I want them implemented. We can but hope.
We can but hope indeed, Brian, and indeed can I once again thank you and all your team there in the inner city helping homeless for what you have done for the citizens of our state and people in need of on-the-spot help, I think is the handiest way of putting it. Because by God, there would be a lot of people, as bad as they are, they would be in a lot worse position except for you and your team in there.
I think that applies though. I know we've said it before, don't you? But I think that applies across the board. Like the volunteer industry in this country in every sense, whether it's housing, mental health, old age pensioner support, the volunteers in this country and the kindness of people in this country is what's keeping it going. If everything was left to state organisations and to the government to fix, we'd be in a hell of a lot worse position than we're in now. So I suppose not only do I want to commend our volunteers, and particularly the people that were on the front line right throughout the pandemic, but also to any volunteer in any other sector that was out there during during COVID-19, trying to support people, trying to make life a bit easier for people. Those are the real heroes, and let's be honest, they're the ones that put themselves at risk to go out there and help others. So I think if we didn't have the level of volunteers and empathy and compassion out of the normal people in this country, the country would be in a lot worse position than we're in now.
Brian, I suppose your biggest fear, and it's just something that came into my mind there in the last couple of seconds, is that, you know, which we have seen before, well, we'll get round to fixing it, but we want a report first on it. And I mean, we've had more reports. The shelves in Leinster House at this stage must be fit to fall off the walls.
Yeah, and I think only if you, I don't know, did you have a read of the programme for government? But obviously I went through the housing and homeless section with a fine-tooth comb. And the one thing that's, obviously with what I do in ICHH, I'm very big on how things are worded. And the one thing that struck me from the programme for government was a lot of non-committal words like we will examine, we will explore, we will investigate. That's not filling me with confidence, because that sounds like, oh, well, we'll have a six-month report to tell us that the previous government didn't do it right. We know they didn't do it right. So this examine, explore, that sort of terminology doesn't fill you with confidence, because they're not saying we will do it. They'll say we will look at it. And that's, again, where the devil is in the detail on exactly what policies Darragh O'Brien puts out there and says that this is exactly what's happening, not a hypothetical on we will look into it. That's not good enough.
Well, the thing about it, of course, Brian, is it then turns into a can-kicking exercise, and we're 6-12 months down the road and the numbers have absolutely mushroomed again.
What we need Darragh O'Brien to come in with the will to eradicate homelessness completely, and not come in with, which is what typically happens with a new government, if I'm a little bit better than the guy before me, well, I can say he didn't do his job right and I'm doing better. That's not acceptable. That's not good enough. Owen Murphy stood over the worst housing crisis in the history of the state and watched it escalate month on month. So saying I'm better than Owen Murphy and Fine Gael were, that's not good enough for us. What we need to see is a real determination and will to eradicate homelessness permanently in the country, and it can be done if the will is there.
Brian McLaughlin, Head of Communications with the Inner City Helping Homeless. Brian, as always, a pleasure, and again, I can't thank you enough for what you're doing, what you do for us here at Near FM, and the amount of time you give us, because I don't think you've ever said no when I rang you for an interview or any of the lads here. So look, we appreciate it, Brian. Keep up the good work, and thank you.
You guys as well, and stay safe, don't you? All the best. Take care.
God bless, Brian. Thank you so much indeed.